Thanks for having me, and I'm delighted to be here. Two young fish were swimming along one fine day, and they noticed an older fish coming the other way. As the older fish drew near, he said to them, "Isn't the water lovely today?" And the younger fish nodded politely, and the fish swam their respective ways. And once the old timer was out of earshot, one young fish turned to the other and said, "What's water?" There are some realities that are so ubiquitous and yet so close to us that we no longer see them. They are like the water in which we swim. And there are many, many things that are like this, parts of our culture that seem so normal to us that we no longer notice them as cultural, parts of our personality, perhaps, that we don't even notice but others find quite obvious. But another example is our health, I think, for many people, that we can be swimming in the water of good health and not be aware of it. This is certainly the case for me as a young man, swimming along happily with moderately good health until the day, it was about two or three days after I finished more college, actually, when I received a cancer diagnosis and was subsequently treated with quite aggressive chemotherapy and radiotherapy at RPA. See me there, sitting in the chemo chair. And that experience really brought home to me a reality that had been so close and so ubiquitous that I hadn't noticed it. There are other realities that share this feature. And I suggest that one of them is our relationship to the created order, our interdependence with it, our reliance on it for every breath of air, every sip of water, every mouthful of food, and for a stable climate in which our civilization has developed. This is a reality that we live and breathe each day and yet often may not give a thought to. I think there are some other parallels with my experience being diagnosed with cancer and receiving treatment. And for a start, there was the question of knowledge. How could I know? I still felt fairly well. I had some symptoms that were a bit odd. I'd lost my voice suddenly. I had a strange sensation in my abdomen. But these doctors with their scans, what did they really know? Could they have been just out to fleece me of my, fleece the government of some more money by giving me unnecessary treatment? Well-meaning friends who advised all kinds of other things I could have done, eaten certain superfoods, or gone and had special acupuncture, or given up on the doctors and just exclusively gone to healing services. I took all those pieces of advice as well-meaning acts of care, but then decided to put them to one side and listen to the actual experts, the people who had dedicated their lives to understanding cancer and to working out the best courses of treatment. And faced with that new reality, that diagnosis, it also meant that I had to make new decisions. I couldn't just go on as I was. I couldn't continue with business as usual in my life, because actually within a few weeks of receiving that diagnosis, some of the symptoms became far more obvious. I became very short of breath as the tumour was starting to obstruct one of my bronchial tubes, and I would be puffed by just climbing a couple of stairs, and it was clear that without quite radical changes and quite radical treatment, then other radical things would happen to me, very bad radical things. So there was no option for things to stay as they were. I either needed to embrace the changes that I was being recommended, or to just accept the changes that came from failing to do that. And there's another parallel too. with climate change and environmental issues, in that at one level I had a straightforward medical problem that required a medical treatment. But that problem came along with other questions for me. It wasn't simply a matter of just going along and accepting this treatment. It raised all kinds of questions about coming to understand my own mortality, understand what it looked like to live well in the face of death, what it looks like to live faithfully with a very uncertain future, and a whole range of other matters. And I think that too is the case for us today. I came across this quote recently from a professor of forestry and environmental studies at Yale, Gus Speth, who says, "I used to think the top environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought that with 30 years of good science, we could address those problems. I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to deal with those, we need a spiritual and cultural transformation, and we scientists don't know how to do that." Now, of course, he's not saying that we don't also need very good science and the best technology that we can develop, but that there are further dimensions to these problems. They're not simply technical problems, but they are cultural problems, they are political, ethical, and spiritual problems. And so today I'm going to outline the mainstream understanding of climate science as it stands today, which may be quite familiar for some of you, but I think is worth doing. Because as an ethicist, understanding our world and our situation is important. We never act in a vacuum. It was important to me that I understood my diagnosis in order to make a responsible decision to receive life-saving treatment. And I think it's important that we understand the science. Though I freely admit I'm not a trained scientist. I've spent a lot of my time in the last few years reading widely in climate science and in the peer-reviewed literature and reading many of the synthesis reports that have come out. And I don't consider myself scientifically illiterate, but I'm not a trained scientist. So while I'm happy later to discuss some of the details, if people do wish to discuss them, if we get too technical, I will simply have to plead ignorance. But having done that, I want to move on to also consider some of the responses that we have to that science, some of the emotional responses, some of the spiritual, ethical, and political responses. And this can be a confronting topic. This can be a topic that raises strong emotions, a topic that is deeply polarised in some parts of the world, and particularly in Australia, a topic with much media noise and confusion, and where often the gap between the reports in the media and what the published science is can be quite wide. I'm sure many of you are aware of the patchy quality of science reporting in the media. And perhaps for those who may not be scientists, you would probably be aware of the patchy quality of reporting on Christianity, for instance. So we're all aware that the media reporting doesn't always give us the best grasp on a situation. But I want us to walk into this with confidence, with, for those of us who are Christians, with faith in a good creator, knowing that we don't need to be scared of the truth. We don't need to be scared of what our current best understanding is, but we can, with humility, seek to understand where we have got to today and so what options are available to us. Paul exhorts his readers, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds." To face uncomfortable realities is pretty much par for the course for Christians. This is something that the scriptures invite us to do regularly, to reflect on our shortcomings and failures and on the ways that we may be participating in harm towards others in order that we might find a true and living way. So let's jump in, and I want to organise our discussion of the science around these four questions. Four quite simple questions. Is it happening? Is it us? Is it bad? And can we do anything? So let's take the first. Is it happening? Here are the global average surface temperatures since 1850. This is a bit of an iconic graph, or actually it's, as you see, multiple different data sets overlaid on top of each other. From the last 160 years, with a lot of noise, a lot of annual variability, but a very strong overall signal of a warming trend in the 20th century, and particularly in the last 30 years or so. But of course, and much of the discussion has focused on this, these data, and what has been happening to the atmospheric surface temperatures. But the atmosphere is only part of the Earth, and the surface is only part of the Earth. When we're talking about global warming as one of the features of climate change, we're talking about more than just atmospheric warming. And we actually find warming across pretty much every system that we have good data for. Various kinds of evidence for warming trends in declining glaciers, declining snow cover, particularly in the northern hemisphere, increasing temperatures over land, that's part of that atmospheric temperature record, as well as temperatures over oceans, tree lines shifting polewards and upwards to higher elevations and higher latitudes, and similarly species shifting polewards and upwards, both terrestrial species and marine species also shifting polewards. Shifts in the timing of seasonal events, such as breeding patterns, hibernation patterns, flowering, peak stream flows, and so on, so that spring is coming earlier and autumn coming later by a couple of weeks. In most places, humidity of the atmosphere increasing, warm air can hold more moisture. So we've seen about a 4% rise in average atmospheric humidity over the recent decades. Permafrost is becoming slightly less perma and is retreating polewards. The ocean is itself warming. Sea ice, the floating ice on the surface of the water, is in decline, particularly in the Arctic, very rapid decline in the Arctic, but globally in decline. Not just in extent, but particularly also in volume, even more so. So just to give one statistic here, the Arctic sea ice, which obviously expands in winter and contracts in summer, if you look at the volume of sea ice at the end of summer, over the period that I've been alive, the last 35 years or so, the volume of sea ice at the end of summer has declined by about 75%. Over that time. Very radical changes to a major feature of the Earth's surface. And the ice sheets, the great land-bound ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica, are losing mass overall. So it is not just the atmospheric temperatures we're talking about here, but across all systems globally, the shifts are happening in this direction. And the amount of heat that we're talking about is truly quite staggering. If you look at this graph, it shows the heat content of the planet, and the land and the atmosphere represent only a tiny fraction of that down the bottom. So the earlier graph that I showed you is just that tiny orange sliver, and the vast majority of the warming is going into the ocean, well over 90%, and that's been known for some decades, so that's where most of the warming is going. If you look at the units on the left there, 10 to the 21 joules, which I'm sure you can do your own calculations as to that, but to put it in some units that might be more easily grasped by our imagination, that means that if we average out the rate of warming over the last few decades of the entire planet, then we're looking at 4 Hiroshima bombs worth of energy being added every second over those decades, or sufficient energy to boil Sydney Harbour dry approximately every 6 hours. So very large shifts in the planetary energy budget. Now, obviously, the planet's a very large place, so that only equates to fractions of a degree. But we're not talking about small amounts of change. Now, changes are also happening in Australia, although something seems to have happened to my actual images here. That is odd. They were working just a few minutes earlier when I skimmed through these. But I can describe what the graphs miss, which is that both ocean and land temperatures in Australia have also been increasing over recent decades. This is all based on a very recent report from the Bureau of Meteorology and CSIRO, jointly published. And the frequency of hot months is increasing and the frequency of cold months is decreasing. But importantly, that doesn't mean that there are no longer any cold months. It's just that the bell curve is shifting to the right, if you like. And so the frequency with which months exceed what is two standard deviations above the long-term mean has shifted from about 2% up to roughly 10% in the last couple of decades. This image does seem to be working. So shifts also in precipitation. As you start to shift temperature and energy around, you're also shifting wind patterns, which leads to changes in precipitation. And so this is changes for one part of the year, April to November, and you see very significant declines happening in the southeast and southwest, with increases in the north. So it's not a simple story to tell for Australia, but there are shifts in those precipitation patterns happening here as well as elsewhere. The frequency of the very hottest days is increasing. So over the temperature record, the top 1% of days, in the first 30 years or so, you only get about one a year on average that falls into that. Whereas in recent, in 2013, we had almost 30 in a single year. 2013 being the hottest year on record for Australia. And if you go back and include part of 2012, then you end up with breaking every monthly record for warmest month, warmest two consecutive months, warmest three, four, five, six, seven, eight, up to 18 consecutive months. This is shifting bushfire danger around Australia. This is the bushfire danger index. Red circles indicate an increase in that danger. Black indicated a decrease. Only at one station is there a decrease, which is not statistically significant, but at more than half the other stations, the increase is statistically significant. So is it happening? Yes. Yes. Unequivocally, yes. This hasn't been in serious dispute for a couple of decades, and is now very widely accepted that the world is indeed warming. But is it us? Climate does indeed vary naturally on various timescales, as many people are keen to remind us, and the planet has indeed been far colder and far warmer in the very distant past. At certain points when the dinosaurs were around, we were looking at 6 degrees warmer, roughly, at the height of glaciation during ice ages, possibly about 5 degrees cooler. And in fact, in the very deep past, even cooler than that. So we certainly haven't departed from the geological record, the range in the geological record. However, geological changes aren't necessarily the ones that are most relevant to us in human society and human lives. And the climate over the last 10,000 years or so has actually been remarkably stable. And that's the period during which human agriculture has flourished and human civilization and cities and human population has increased. We've known for at least 150 years that certain gases, greenhouse gases, trap incoming solar radiation like a blanket by being transparent to visible light but opaque to infrared radiation or partially opaque to it, and so holding some of that extra energy closer to the Earth's surface. And we've known for at least 60 years that our emissions are increasing the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide in particular. And here is another iconic graph, the Keeling curve, named after Professor Keeling, who first started systematic measurements in Hawaii back in the late 1950s. And you see there the annual soil pattern rising and falling, but a very, very strong overall trend. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this. This is just a basic schematic of the energy being kept closer to the Earth's surface. And if you thicken the blanket, if you increase the concentration of those greenhouse gases, then more energy is retained close to the Earth's surface. So we have good reason to believe that adding greenhouse gases is going to affect temperature. We also have investigated all the other possible suspects, all the other known causes of climate changes in the past and postulated causes today, things such as solar variation and orbital cycles, volcanoes, and aerosols, both natural and human, and basically all other suggested causes of recently observed warming are insufficient to explain the observed trend in the absence of greenhouse gases. It's only when we include human emissions of greenhouse gases do models match the observed warming and match other patterns in the data, actually. So that natural variation has continued, but overall it's probably played a slight cooling role in recent decades. And so you see down the bottom there a graph of many model runs in this particular study, some with only natural forcings in blue, which covers much of the first half of the century, but in the second half of the 20th century there's a departure between that and the observed temperatures in black, and it's only when you add together anthropogenic and natural forcings that you get models that more closely match what we've actually experienced. But there are other patterns in the data too that point to human causation being primary. Some of them listed here, nights warming faster than days and winter warming faster than summer, and a cooling upper atmosphere, all of which would not be the case were the sun the primary culprit. Satellite data can measure less heat escaping to space than coming in, and can see that the holes in that outgoing radiation occur at wavelengths that carbon dioxide traps and other greenhouse gases. So all these different fingerprints point to human causation as the primary influence in recently observed warming. And a number of studies have tried to quantify that contribution. Obviously, we're not the only thing happening. There are also natural forcings, but how much is it us and how much is it natural forcings? Here are eight different studies that have attempted to quantify that, reaching answers that differ a bit, but in the same kind of ballpark. And most of them find roughly 100% or a bit more. How is it possible to have more than 100% contribution? Well, that's because of a slight cooling trend that would probably have been the case in the absence of our emissions. Now, that's eight studies. Have I just cherry-picked my eight? Might there be others that disagree? Well, a very interesting study that came out last year led by an Australian, attempted to quantify the level of agreement on this question in the scientific literature and looked at 14,000 papers published since 1991. With global warming or climate change or similar terms in the abstract, and categorised the abstracts on the basis of whether they accepted that mainstream position that humanity is responsible for the majority of warming in the last half century or so, whether they disagreed with it, whether that was explicit or implicitly in both cases, or whether they took no position. And of those 14,000, most took no position because they were on other matters related to it. They weren't trying to answer this question. But of those that took a position, about 4,000 of them, 97% either explicitly or implicitly accepted, endorsed that mainstream understanding, with a slight increase over those two decades. But even back in the early 90s, very strong levels of agreement. This isn't a recently arrived at conclusion. However, if you ask the public what proportion of climate experts agree that humans are the primary cause, most people think it's about half of scientists. So there's quite a gap there between the 97% consensus in the published papers and the public perception that there is very significant scientific disagreement ongoing. In fact, if you look at another way of trying to quantify the consensus, if you add up scientific institutions of national or international standing that are relevant to climate science, so things like CSIRO or the National Academy of Science or Bureau of Meteorology in Australia, or a number of particular disciplinary organisations. So with national or international standing, there are about 198 that have explicitly endorsed this finding. Having looked at the data, they have decided to risk their reputation on accepting this finding. And the number that have explicitly rejected it is zero. So is it happening? Unequivocally, yes. Is it us? More than 97% of papers say so, and every scientific institution to have taken a position on this with national or international standing says yes. But is it bad? Might it be the case that there are upsides to it, or might the changes be so small and so slow that we don't really notice them? As I said before, the Earth has been far warmer and far colder in the deep past, and yet human civilization has only experienced a relatively narrow range of global temperatures, roughly about a degree range, plus or minus, since we started building cities, so the last 10,000 years or so. And in determining the danger, it's the rate of change that's the real key. It's not just the degree of change, but how fast those changes occur. Because we can go back to the height of the last glacial, where the Earth was probably about 4, maybe 5 degrees colder than present, and the sea levels were more than 100 metres lower. Great ice sheets locked up all that water, particularly in the northern hemisphere, great ice sheets over North America and Eurasia, a mile of ice over Chicago and ice almost down to London. A radically different world, about 4 degrees or so colder than today, and yet it took about 10,000 years to move from that world to the world of the Holocene, the world of human civilization, the more recent period of climatic stability. And this is a bit of a hybrid graph that someone has put together with proxy data in green for reconstructing the global temperature coming out of the last glacial. In blue, a reconstruction of the Holocene temperature. And you see the very end of that blue, there's a bit of an uptick, in fact, quite a sharp uptick. That's the last century, or 50 years in particular. And then in red, added on top of that, model projections of middle of the range warming for this century. And you see there the rate of change is quite different. That we may be heading for a change on a similar kind of magnitude to that experience between a glacial and an interglacial, but rather than that occurring over 8 to 10,000 years, that kind of change happening in 100 years, so 80 to 100 times faster. And if you're in a car travelling at 100 k's an hour and you decide to put on the brakes and you slow down to zero, then that's one thing, and you'll probably do fine. If you're in a car travelling at 100 kilometres an hour and you hit a brick wall, you may end up at 0 kilometres an hour. But it's the rate of change that is the killer. It's the rate of change that is key. I might move over some of these quickly. Some more reconstructions of... actually, this is an important one. This isn't a reconstruction. This and the next graph are direct measurements of fossil air. So if you drill down into the ice sheet, particularly in Antarctica, but also in Greenland, you get annual bands of snowfall that gets compacted into ice and traps with it tiny bubbles of air that were present in the atmosphere when that snow fell. When we drill down cores 2 kilometres, 3 kilometres into the Antarctic ice sheet, we can go back here 400,000 years, or actually in a couple of the cores back to more than 800,000 years, with a year-by-year record of the atmospheric composition at that time. And so we can see here changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide over timescales of hundreds of thousands of years, and the peaks coincide with the interglacials quite neatly, and the troughs coincide with the glacials. But we see that during that whole period, as far back as we can go, as far back as there has been ice still remaining in Antarctica, the atmospheric concentrations have varied between about 180, 170 parts per million and 280, 80, 300 parts per million, that kind of a range. This graph is actually a few years out of date. We are now nudging 400. So we have well and truly departed from conditions that have existed for at least 800,000 years and quite probably quite a few million years. And the rate of change happening in carbon dioxide levels is faster than at any time in that record by a factor of roughly 10. That's another reconstruction of the Holocene surface temperatures. So when asking is it bad, that's one of the things we need to keep in mind, that we're talking about widespread changes to the Earth's surface but occurring at rates that exceed anything experienced by humanity and indeed exceed anything experienced by almost any species alive today. There are only a few points in the geological record that come close to being similar to the rates of change that we're currently experiencing. All of them associated with mass extinction events. Now, there are a number of impacts associated with a warming planet: physical impacts, social impacts, ecosystem impacts. The physical ones are the ones that get the most discussion. That's what people think of: hotter, more heat waves, more frequent, worse heat waves. Heat waves in Australia have already doubled in the last couple of decades. An intensification of the hydrological cycle, that's both worse flooding and worse droughts, because increased atmospheric temperature leads to more evaporation. So more evaporation means less soil moisture, which worsens droughts, but it also means greater potential for intense precipitation events. And so in different parts of the world, some will be more susceptible to droughts, some more susceptible to floods, some get both. But roughly speaking, places that are already dry will probably end up drier, and those that are already wet will probably end up wetter. Which sounds a little bit like one of the sayings of Jesus, though I'm sure that's not what he was talking about here. Cryosphere decline, so melting ice, and sea level rise, both as the ice melts and as the waters warm, you get thermal expansion. And we've already seen a bit over 20 centimetres of sea level rise in the last century, with projections of about a metre, plus or minus, on a business-as-usual scenario for this century. But the thing about sea level rise is that it takes a long time to get going. The great ice sheets have a lot of inertia, but once they do get going, they are likely to be very difficult to stop, so that if we do see 1 metre rise by the end of this century, we could well be locking in many, many metres or tens of metres of sea level rise over the long term. Now, these physical impacts get a lot of discussion, but there are second-order social impacts as well, and these are actually, I think, some of the more concerning ones. Agricultural impacts, the recent IPCC report that just came out, said that business as usual could be up to 2% decline in agricultural yield per decade over this century. You add that up, and that's quite a significant decline in a world that will probably get up to 9 or 10 billion people on our current trajectory, and where diets are expanding and more people want to eat a Western diet. But as you have disruption of the hydrological cycle, as you have more heat waves, these things take their toll. Particularly heat waves, most grain crops have maximum heat thresholds, and if you exceed that for a certain number of days, then the yield starts dropping off pretty rapidly. Economic impacts, both direct and indirect. Public health impacts, the British journal The Lancet in 2011 edition on climate change that called climate change the greatest public health threat of the 21st century. And the recent IPCC report also emphasised that this is increasingly understood to be the case, that the public health impacts are quite significant. There are cultural impacts. Just think as an example, low-lying islands that may need to be evacuated. People are unlikely to drown as the seas rise. It's not rising that quickly. But leaving behind your ancestral home has all kinds of implications, not just legal and geopolitical implications, but cultural implications and for identity. And then there are geopolitical impacts. I'll mention two. One is migration, which, as we're aware in Australia, migration of refugees can cause tensions in other places. And to pick the what may well be the most significant threat here, Bangladesh has well over 100 million people, 120 million, I think, and yet roughly half of its land area is below 1 metre. India has spent the last decade or two building the longest fence in the world that runs almost the entire length of their land border, fourth longest land border in the world between India and Bangladesh because it's so wavy. And it's a militarised border with an almost 3 metre tall fence and guards who are instructed to shoot on sight. And more than 1,000 people have been shot attempting to make that crossing. I put there Arab Spring. This is a bit more complex, but the events of the Arab Spring in early 2011, all the countries that saw civil unrest, revolutions, violence, civil wars during that period, all of them are significant grain importers. All of them have significant portions of their population living in poverty, who spend large percentages of their income on food. And in the months leading up to those disturbances, the world grain prices almost doubled in a couple of months. Now, why did they jump up so much? They're complex factors, but one of the significant triggers for that was the failure of grain harvest in many places almost simultaneously. So Russia, for instance, went from being the third largest wheat exporter to cancelling all wheat exports due to a massive heat wave. It was a six sigma heat wave, six standard deviations above the norm. Argentina took a hit on its grain production from big floods. That was the year of the Queensland floods, which also affected agricultural production in Australia. Pakistan saw 20 million people displaced by huge floods there. That also affected their grain crop. And so what I'm not saying is that climate change caused the Arab Spring, but what I am saying is that climate change made more likely the kind of events that trigger unrest or that are associated with unrest, food price volatility. And so I saw just in the last 24 hours that the Pentagon has put out their latest security report, and they identify climate change once again as a threat multiplier. So taking existing security threats and worsening the conditions under which they are occurring. And then there are ecosystem impacts too. It's not just about humans, but it is especially about humans. It's certainly not just about polar bears, but very significant ecosystem changes. On a sort of middle-of-the-road amount of warming this century, I think it's 40% of all terrestrial biomes will shift to a different biome. So that is things like forests shifting to savanna, or permafrost shifting to forest. So very widespread changes. And the implications for biodiversity are particularly severe. Species can migrate, but many species can't migrate that quickly, particularly things like trees. And particularly for species who already live in ecosystems that are fragmented from development or logging or other impacts, there may be nowhere for them to migrate to, or for species who are already at the poleward edge of their continent, or for species who are already high in mountain ranges and have nowhere further to climb up to. And then there are the possibility of abrupt or non-linear changes, because it's not simply the case that is, we may pass thresholds beyond which some of the changes become self-reinforcing. So if you think about permafrost thawing, permafrost is frozen plant mass As it thaws, it decomposes, it releases carbon, either as carbon dioxide or methane, which is even more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. And so that's a positive feedback. The more warming you get, the more greenhouse gases you end up with, and so the more warming you get. It's possible this is an area very much of active research, that some of those changes may not be smooth or linear, but could happen quite abruptly. So to summarise the climate impacts, we have here a bit of a thermometer on the left, with zero being the pre-industrial baseline of the average temperature at which civilization developed over the last 10,000 years or so. We've got our current level of observed warming of about 0.8, or really about 0.9 by now. I should update that. We then have further warming already in the pipeline. Now, this is because of the fact I mentioned earlier that 90% of the warming is going into the oceans. That heat takes a while to work its way through to being released into the atmosphere. And so there's quite a bit of inertia that once you get the oceans warming, then you're committed to a certain further degree of atmospheric warming over the next few decades, even if you manage to stabilise atmospheric concentrations. And so if we stabilised atmospheric concentrations at their current level, that is, if we cut emissions to close to zero overnight, we would continue probably to seeing warming for some decades up to roughly 1.5, though that has some significant error bars on that. But it's widely agreed that there is that inertia, and that we will see further warming. 2 degrees is then the universally agreed maximum allowed warming. So the 2009 Copenhagen Climate Summit that got a lot of media attention, and which most observers thought the outcome was largely a failure. The one document that did come out of that, the one high-profile document, was only a few pages long, the Copenhagen Accord. The one number that appeared in that document, signed ultimately by most of the countries there, was that warming should be no more than 2 degrees above the pre-industrial baseline. Now, there were some countries that didn't sign it, but that was because they wanted that number to be 1.5, that is, they wanted a lower number. So everyone has agreed that 2 degrees is the upper limit of acceptable warming. The bad news is 2 degrees is still too high to really be safe and too low to be possible on current political assumptions. 2 degrees warming would lead to multi-metre sea level rise over the next centuries. It could possibly lose all or most of the Greenland ice sheet over centuries, ultimately adding 7 metres of sea level rise. 2 degrees could mean, again, large error bars here, but 30% of all species committed to extinction. 2 degrees is likely to be a death sentence for most coral reef ecosystems. They would shift from being coral-dominated species ecosystems to algae-dominated ecosystems, the victory of slime. Could suppress crop yields in the order of 20% globally. Now that there are some places that are winners slightly, and many places that are much bigger losers than that, particularly much of Africa. And it would mean that the new temperature ranges are outside of the historic temperature range if you look at annual temperatures. So that is, the very warmest years of the 20th century would be colder than the very coldest years by the time we reach 2 degrees of warming. So we would be on another planet in a climate unlike anything we'd experienced. And yet, too high to be safe, but too low to be possible on current assumptions. We are very likely to sail way past 2 degrees without some very significant shifts in the current political arrangements. Because if... So one of the other outcomes of Copenhagen was that countries submitted voluntary pledges so that each country said what they were prepared to aim for, and all those pledges can be gathered together in a central place. Many countries made conditional pledges and unconditional pledges. So like Australia, we pledged to cut our emissions by 2020 by 5% from 2000 levels unconditionally, although the current administration has indicated that that's a soft target that they're prepared to walk away from. and a conditional pledge of 25% by 2020 in the if there is a strong international agreement. So if everyone else does it, then we'll lift our game. Now, if we take the maximum pledges of every country, so that for Australia means a 25% reduction from 2000 levels by 2020, and anyone watching Australian politics can tell you how likely that is under our current assumptions. But if every country keeps all their maximal pledges, then we're probably heading to almost 4 degrees, 3.5 to 4 degrees. And the impacts at 4 degrees are known with less certainty than for lower levels. This is partially because more work has been done on the lower levels of warming, which was genuinely because climate scientists didn't think we were likely to be that stupid. But it's also because it's considerably more complex to work out what the impacts are going to be, because you have multiple complex systems interacting, and it's hard to tell exactly how it's going to end up. But there's increasingly been work done on this, and a number of conferences that have focused on what a 4-degree world might look like, one in Melbourne, one in Oxford, and a number of others in the last couple of years. And where we're at 4 degrees, these conferences conclude that human civilization as we know it is probably in the balance. We may well be exceeding the rate of change and degree of change that it's possible for us to adapt to. And certainly many natural systems will find their thresholds exceeded. So just as coral reefs are probably one of the more sensitive ecosystems, likely nearly all tropical coral reef ecosystems being lost by 2 degrees of warming, by the time you get to 4 degrees, very many ecosystems will face catastrophic changes. For instance, quite likely that a fair slab of the Amazon rainforest could shift to savanna, could just dry out and become too dry for a rainforest, and will likely burn and be replaced by grassland. And 4 degrees is also very likely unstable. Now, again, this isn't known with as much confidence as some of the other things I've been talking about. It is known with high confidence that there are likely to be thresholds beyond which further warming becomes guaranteed. That is, we set off positive feedbacks that take us well beyond the warming that we would have got to just from our own emissions. It's not known exactly where some of those thresholds are, but the higher you go, the more likely it is that you're going to reach one. It's a bit like Russian roulette. The more times you pull the trigger, you can't guarantee whether or not you will end up shooting yourself, but the more times you pull it, the more likely that becomes. And so, again, acknowledging that I'm shifting from what is known with high confidence to what is known with less confidence, here are some quotes from some senior scientific figures on their understanding of a 4-degree world. So Professor Kevin Anderson in the UK, one of the senior climate figures in the UK, a 4°C future is incompatible with an organised global community, is likely to be beyond adaptation, is devastating to the majority of ecosystems, and has a high probability of not being stable. Now, he was summarising one of those conferences, the Oxford conference in 2011. And Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber, who's Angela Merkel's scientific advisor, and one of the senior climate scientists in Germany, said in 2009, what's the difference between 2 degrees and 4 degrees? The difference is human civilization. On a 4-degree world, the planet's carrying capacity estimates are below 1 billion people. Now, again, he's not drawing on a particular peer-reviewed study here. He is telling us his judgment of looking at impacts. Obviously, carrying capacity is quite a flexible notion, complex in its own right. The main point is such a thoroughly different world that the capacity for human flourishing has been very, very significantly diminished. And even the hippies at the World Bank, the impacts of the extreme heat waves projected for a 4-degree world have not been evaluated, but they could be expected to vastly exceed the consequences experienced to date and potentially exceed the adaptive capacities of many societies and natural systems. Thus, given that uncertainty remains about the full nature and scale of impacts, there's also no certainty that adaptation is possible. So for the green world, if we meet all our current maximal pledges, if those pledges turn out to be hot air, then all bets are off. So is it bad? Well, I'll let you draw your own conclusions. But can we do anything? Can we do anything? The key to doing something is this pair of things. Managing the unavoidable and avoiding the unmanageable. That is, there is already further warming in the system, further disruption to come, no matter what we do. And so we need to be preparing for that disruption. But, as we've just seen, if we're not also reducing the rate of change, if we're not also reducing the size of the problem, it's quite likely that those changes may overwhelm our capacity to adapt. And so we need to avoid the unmanageable. We need to aim for slower, smaller changes. And at the core of that means not putting as much fossil carbon into the atmosphere, leaving it buried safely underground. And so in order to have a decent chance of staying below 2 degrees, we need to leave most, that is 80%, of fossil fuel reserves in the ground. And that means cutting our carbon footprint in the wealthy world by, well, actually the global carbon footprint by about 90 degrees or more in a matter of decades, and the wealthy world perhaps by 95%. Now these immediately raise two sets of problems. One, a set of technical problems of, well, where are we going to get our energy from if we're not burning as much fossil fuels, but also another set of problems that in some ways may turn out to be considerably harder, which is how can we change the fossil fuel reserves are controlled by companies who are some of the largest companies in the history of money, with more political clout than almost any other industry, and in many cases controlled by national governments that are not particularly known for putting the welfare of their people at the top of their agenda. And so to do anything like this, to come anywhere close to keeping 80% of fossil fuel reserves in the ground, is going to require large changes at cultural, economic, infrastructural, behavioural and political levels. I don't think there is a silver bullet. I'm happy to talk about some of the proposed silver bullet techno fixes. I think they all have significant drawbacks. We may need elements of each of them. But there's more than a technical problem here. And if you do add all those technical responses together, we do get into the right ballpark. So it is technically feasible. There are alternative, clean, smart energy sources that exist for everyone to live a flourishing life. For example, the sunlight falling on the Earth each hour is the equivalent of total annual human energy demand. Now, obviously, it's quite a tricky thing to harness some significant fraction of that, even to get 1% of it. And yet the potential resources there are very large. And when the costs are added up, the costs are large but manageable, on the order of 1 or 2% of global GDP. So certainly a very large cost and a shift, but not impossibly so. And if we can get our emissions seriously under control, then the smaller, slower changes are probably possible to adapt to. We're not, probably not too late. But what is missing largely is political will. Anyone who has observed the US Congress or Australian Parliament will realise that these political authorities often make noises about climate change, but when you actually look at what they do, it's relatively little. And there are vested interests that pollute the media and our political discourse. That there are strong ideological and economic forces operating, similar to the case with tobacco, where the tobacco industry spent decades funding a misinformation campaign in order to obfuscate the medical data about the dangers of smoking. There's been a well-funded, well-documented, well-funded misinformation campaign from fossil fuel interests to pollute the public understanding and secure the support of political authorities, which has left the general population largely confused and apathetic and divided. Media sources that don't, on the whole, do a very good job of reporting the science, some better than others, but certainly many of the most widely read sources do a worse than average job on that. I was reminded of that just this week as the latest IPCC report came out, the second working group, major scientific publication of 2,600 pages with thousands of contributing scientists and hundreds of authors, signed off by every government in the world, and the sum total of the reporting in the Murdoch Press in Australia was one article in The Australian, buried somewhere in the middle, that said the silver lining to climate change or something similar, where they picked one or two small elements in that report that were about some changes that may have positive impacts, and ignored the overwhelming conclusion of the dangers. And that is utterly par for the course. And so we have a large degree of political, economic and infrastructural inertia on this problem. Infrastructural inertia, because once you build some of the infrastructure, it's there for decades. If you build a big new coal port, it's only going to be profitable if you get coal flowing through it for decades. If you start a new coal mine, it's only going to be profitable if you can keep digging coal out of it for decades. If you build a new coal plant, then the profits rely on its operation for a long time to pay off the initial investment. And so once you have sunk costs into infrastructure, it's even more difficult to move away from that. But the good news is repentance is possible. This is one point where being a Christian, for me, makes a difference. One of my supervisors once wrote, "The most fundamental of all human freedoms is the freedom to repent, the freedom to change our mind, to do something different." But there are other pieces of good news that many of the changes that are required have very significant co-benefits. So we have here a cartoon, someone standing up in a climate summit where the presenter has just been listing many of these co-benefits: energy independence, preserve rainforests, sustainability, green jobs, livable cities, clean air and water, and so on. And someone stands up to ask the question, what if it's a big hoax and we create a better world for nothing? Just one of those co-benefits, combustion of coal in China and Southeast Asia is killing something on the order of 4 million people a year. 3 or 4 million currently, and shortening the lives of hundreds of thousands of others, moving away from these dirty sources of pollution. Now, I'm just talking about straightforward particulate pollution there, the traditional kind, not even climate pollution. Moving away from that dirty coal to cleaner sources of energy will just have major benefits for public health in those regions, which then flows on to a whole range of other benefits. Can we do anything? Yes. We have seen in the past massive transformation of economies almost overnight. So the example that's often used is the Allied mobilisation in World War II, where if you look at the US economy in 1941, on the day that the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, 1.6% of US GDP was going into military spending. By the time the Japanese surrendered in 1945, 37% of US GDP was going into military spending, with a 75% increase in the US economy over those 4 years. That was one of the fastest transformations of an economy in human history. President Roosevelt. Who was president at the start? Roosevelt, Eisenhower. Truman at the end. Roosevelt at the start, yes. Yes, FDR. days after Pearl Harbor was attacked, called the heads of the big four auto companies who built basically all the world's cars at that point into the Oval Office and said, look, we're going to war with Japan. I'm going to need you guys to start building us equipment. We need tanks and this many planes and this many boats. And the auto guy said, oh, wait, Mr. President, we can't possibly do that. We're flat out building cars. He said, you don't understand. You're not going to build any more cars. And almost overnight, they stopped building cars. And for the duration of the war, they built almost no cars and instead built the largest war machine the world had ever known at that time. And that just showed what was possible with strong political will. Now, obviously, we're nowhere near having that level of political will, but it shows that it is technically, economically, possible to very rapidly change things if and when we decide to. The danger is that, because of the inertia that I was talking about, by the time we actually decide to do things, things will keep getting worse for a while. So if we wait until it's so bad that we can barely stand it anymore, and then we throw all our energy into it, it'll keep getting worse. And so at this point, I think it's helpful to have this perspective, that changes are inevitable. There are now no non-radical options. Here's a quote I found the other day. It's common among certain of our allies, speaking about people concerned about climate, to try to avoid seeming like radicals by reassuring people that a sustainable world won't be all that different from the world we live in now. It's time for us to stop saying that. It's time for us to stop saying that because it's not true. The kind of world we will be building will have to include what are, from today's perspective, some truly massive changes. We won't be living the same way in a couple of decades, either because we've undergone some relatively profound transformations or because the consequences of failing to change our ways will be coming home to roost in a series of utterly predictable disasters. So think back to my climate diagnosis. There were no non-radical options there. I either accepted the radical consequences of not being treated, which likely would have meant death in a couple of months at most, or I accepted very radical treatment that probably saved my life, almost certainly saved my life, and I've now been clear for a number of years. I didn't mention that before. I hope you weren't feeling worried for me this whole time. But which did also do damage on the way. But there were no non-radical options available to me at that point. And I think it's similar for us now. or to put it another way, I would like to say that taking radical action on climate change is actually a very conservative thing to do. That is, the instinct that says, I want to hand on to my children a planet that bears some resemblance to the one that I received from my parents. That's a conservative instinct. The radicals are the ones who want to conduct a grand experiment with the chemistry of our oceans and atmosphere for the sake of short-term profit. So, the four questions, is it happening? Is it us? Is it bad? Can we do anything? The answers to each of those are the same. Yes. So if you take anything from tonight, is it happening? Yes. Is it us? Yes. Is it bad? Yes. Can we do anything? Yes. At this point, a brief note on Australia's oversized role. Sometimes people want to say, we're too small to really do anything, we just need to wait for others to lead. Actually, we're a major player in this. We punch way above our weight. We have amongst the highest per capita carbon footprint in the OECD, even excluding our exports of fossil fuels. And in fact, about those exports, they're actually significantly larger than our domestic emissions. So that our export of coal is the emissions that result from that when that coal is burnt are roughly double our domestic emissions. And that means that all up, we are the fifth largest, or maybe now sixth largest, extractor of fossil fuels. That's not per capita, but there are only four or five countries that dig up more fossil carbon than we do. And we are the Saudi Arabia of coal. We are the pretty close to equal first or very close second largest exporter of coal, along with Indonesia. And our share of the international coal market is larger than Saudi Arabia's share of the international oil market. And both sides of politics plan to double fossil fuel carbon extraction in coming decades. That is, plans to very significantly expand this with new mines, new coal ports, new rail lines, many of these already being constructed or at the planning and approval stage. And this is where the front line really is in one of the major front lines in the battle for a habitable planet is happening here in Australia with some of these expansions of infrastructure to continue the extraction of fossil fuels that will lock in many, many millions and even billions of tonnes of extra carbon dioxide for decades. And we also have some of the least ambitious reduction targets of all developed nations. And yet, current analyses suggest that we're likely to fail to meet even those modest targets. Sorry, that's a typo there. That should be 5% from 2000 levels. So, at this point, I want to pause and ask, how are you feeling? Just reflect on that for a bit. We can talk about your responses to that in question time in a few minutes. But I suspect if you're like most people, you're probably feeling some mix of these. Some anxiety, perhaps some guilt, maybe some anger, sadness, and perhaps some helplessness. And I think these are all forms of grief. And I want to say that these are healthy, understandable, natural responses, right and proper responses, to this kind of news. Just as when I received my diagnosis, it would have been odd if I didn't have an emotional response to that. It would have meant that somehow I was disconnected. But these emotional responses are right and proper, and yet they're very uncomfortable. None of these are positive feelings. These are feelings that we don't like to have to experience. And so in order to manage them, many of us engage in a wide range of coping mechanisms. Some of these are good and healthy coping mechanisms. Some of them may be partially effective, but ultimately counterproductive. That is, they may help us to maintain a sense of stability in our life and not be overwhelmed by those emotions, but they may lead us away from doing anything about the problem. And so some of these maladaptive coping strategies I call the six Ds. Denial, disavowal, disengagement, distraction, desperation, and despair. And each of these is a way of managing emotions, fails to actually address the cause of the problem. So there's outright denial, which gets a fair bit of discussion. And a lot of the discussion in the psychological literature talks about identity protective cognition. That is that we interpret information that threatens our identity in such a way as to limit that threat. Climate change threatens our identity for many of us. It threatens some of the narratives that we cherish. It threatens some of our assumptions, our dreams. It may threaten our sense of self, perhaps of contribution. And those threats threaten to shift our identity. And so to avoid that, to manage that, sometimes we want to reinterpret that information in order to make it seem less threatening. But denial, outright denial, isn't the only way that we do that. There can also be disavowal, which is where we accept the facts, but we deny the implications of them. And this is where I put many politicians, where at least on the surface they accept the facts, but by their actions they show that they're not really accepting the implications of those facts. Or disengagement. Some fascinating qualitative studies in Norway and in the US suggest that if you talk to that segment of the population that would normally get classified as apathetic about environmental concerns, so there's a certain segment of the population to say, oh, I don't care about it. If you go and interview them in depth, these studies found that for most of those people, that apathy is a mask hiding deep grief about the topic. That they say they don't care, but actually they care very deeply, but feel powerless to do anything, and so shut down. Or distraction, we find reasons to look away or to shift the blame, or we engage in tokenistic behaviour. We might religiously recycle, and the key word there is religiously, because it's having a function for us in holding at bay, like a talisman, holding those fears at bay. I'm doing my bit, at least. Desperation, where we might reach for whatever seems closest to hand and just blindly accept a proposed techno fix, or start to dream about survivalist fantasies of grabbing a gun and some tinned food and heading out to the bush somewhere, or amongst activists engaging in violent acts of revolution to try to force change. I'm not talking there about non-violent direct action, for which I have a lot of respect. I'm talking there about violent attempts to change the system, or despair and just feeling paralysed, and that's certainly where I've spent a lot of my time in the last few years. But as Christians, I think one of the ways forward is through, well, not just for Christians, but I think Christians have some particular resources to help this, is through a good grieving process, a process in which we walk into that grief and through it, and find amidst it reasons to keep going and to act. And I think at the heart of grieving well is maintaining a sense of delight and gratitude for the good world. One of the temptations is a disengagement where we withdraw our affections from the things that are threatened. But in order to grieve well, we need to acknowledge, no, I do actually love these things. They are really good. I don't want the polar bears to die. I don't want Bangladeshis to suffer a horrible, constrained future. I don't want instability and worsening conditions of conflict, because these things that are threatened are good things, and I give thanks for them. It also requires honesty with ourselves and with one another. This goes back to the Romans passage before, that we open ourselves to transformation. We open ourselves to the reality of our situation, the reality of the threat that we face, and the reality of God's grace and the reality of the possibility of change. Part of that honesty is naming things, naming what perhaps has already been lost, naming what is threatened, and perhaps naming some of the dreams that are challenged by climate change that may have been illusions to begin with. And then we repent. This is what Christians do, where we find ourselves mired in a situation, is that we may not be responsible for all of it. In fact, we may only be responsible for a small part of it, but we take responsibility for our involvement in it. We seek to understand how we may have been contributing to it, even inadvertently, and we turn our back on that. We reject it and we seek a new and living way through the goodness of God's grace and forgiveness. Part of grieving well is recapturing the scriptural tradition of lament, that throughout the scriptures, particularly in parts of the Psalms, you have their models of grieving well, of taking that grief to God, working through it, seeking God's promises, seeking forgiveness, seeking hope, and finding reasons to keep moving forward in love. Grief can be isolating. And if we are to act, then acting in communities, living in communities, is the only way forward. And so speaking about these things is important. This is one of those topics that, because of its because of the controversy around it and the polarisation, because of the uncomfortable emotions that it generates in people, we don't want to talk about it. But I think it is important that we do talk about it with family and friends, that we ask each other how we are going. We acknowledge the emotions that we might be feeling about it. And then we seek God's comfort and hope in the knowledge that God is with us, even in the darkest of days, and that his hope of a new life and new world means that even in the deadliest of ends, all is not lost, that God's plans are not thwarted by human failure, even catastrophic human failure. So then that frees us from being paralysed by those fears. So in the end, to summarise here, as I reach the end of my presentation, for Christians and climate, the choice is really about the two great commandments that Jesus gave, that we should love the Lord our God wholeheartedly and love our neighbour as ourself. And so the choice is, will we love our Creator, or will we participate in the undoing of his good creation, in the decreation of his rich, abundant, beautiful world? Will we love our neighbour in sacrificial care, or will we ignore their plight? And particularly those neighbours who are most vulnerable and yet who have done the least to contribute to the problem. So I think there are three groups there that all will suffer worse impacts than average, and yet none of those groups has really contributed very much to the problem. And so this is really a matter of justice at its core here, intergenerational justice, global justice, and even interspecies justice. So how do we move forward if we want to move forward in love for our Creator and our neighbour? I think part of what we need to do is challenge dominant cultural narratives. The climate crisis is a teachable moment that enables some of these dominant narratives to be split open or brought into question. And I won't go through these in depth. We can discuss them more in question time. I'll just pick on the first one there. I think one of the very dominant narratives in our culture, another part of the water in which we swim that often doesn't get acknowledged, is consumerism. That we are what we buy, that freedom of choice is the most valuable of commodities, that the one who dies with the most toys wins. And yet that many of those assumptions reinforced by the multi-billion dollar advertising industry designed to make you discontent with life, those assumptions on the one hand are some of the key drivers of climate change, because they lead to very energy intense lifestyles with high levels of consumption of material goods that all need energy to be produced and shipped around and operated. But on the other hand, consumerism, I think, is just fundamentally incompatible with the Christian gospel, where Jesus says life does not consist in the abundance of possessions and warns us against the love of money as a root of all kinds of evil, in the Epistle to Timothy. And so I think that there are gospel alternatives to these dominant narratives, and that the climate crisis actually gives the church a chance to restate, to rediscover the good news of Jesus in a new context, where we rediscover that what we knew all along, that idolatry is destructive, and turning to Christ in humility and seeking repentance and a new and living way is liberation. And so our identity comes through faith in a crucified Lord rather than through what we buy. So then my final slide, where I list three practical steps that we might like to take things a step further. First is to learn more. I've scratched the surface today. This is a very complex topic. At heart, it's simple, and the matters of justice are really quite simple, but the solutions become quite complex. And so learning more is an important thing, and finding reputable sources, which, again, I'm sure I don't need to tell a bunch of scientists not to just base that on bloggers or the mainstream media, but to actually find reputable peer-reviewed sources for your understanding of these things. Second, to address your own life and to seek to throw off the narrative of consumerism, but simplifying, which is good for the planet and good for your soul. And that can be everything from turning off the television and so exposing yourself less to advertising, through to seeking more energy efficient appliances, through to seeking to invest more in your local area rather than living your life spread around the entire planet, and so using less energy for transport. It may be switching to renewable electricity, paying a little bit more for electricity, so that rather than passing off the costs of fossil fuels onto future generations, you choose to pay some of that cost by paying more for renewable power. And the third suggestion is divestment. This is, I think, one of the most exciting campaigns happening at the moment around climate, which is targeting mid-level institutions with a social conscience, such as universities, churches, city governments, and asking them that if it's wrong to destroy the habitable planet, then it's wrong to profit from that destruction. And so why not move your money out of fossil fuels, move any investments, stocks and shares, out of fossil fuel companies. With the goal not being to harm those companies directly financially, they're so massive that they wouldn't even notice it, but to revoke their social license, to shift the wind in the political discourse by repositioning fossil fuel companies as being more akin to tobacco companies or asbestos companies. That is profitable, but really quite harmful, they ought to be an embarrassment for a politician to be seen with or to be seen taking money from, because really it's the respectability as well as the profitability of the fossil fuel companies that ensures their political clout and ensures that they get to keep on setting the playing field in ways that is amenable to them. And I can include in the information with these slides some links for you to chase up on any of those. And I finished there with... I started with a picture of me sitting down, and I finished with a different picture of me sitting down. Part of speaking up, maybe joining campaigns that are seeking to slow the destruction of the planet or move to a better world. So that was me a few weeks ago, choosing to sit in a road that is one of the access roads to the largest open-cut coal mine currently under construction in Australia, up at Maules Creek, with the very fine police there looking after me. So I think we are now to have a short break and then have question time, is that right?
Yeah, but maybe if we had some questions, then we...
Oh, okay. Yep. Okay, sure. Yep, move straight into questions. Sorry, I misunderstood. Yep. So there are many different topics you may wish to address. There's the science itself, but then there are the whole range of responses here. So this is just a little bit of a menu. I'm sorry, the text is quite small. But there are many facets of our response, and so I've put up some stimulus there that might help to arrange some of these questions. Great. Okay, yep.
You've mentioned that time is very important. If we don't take action soon, we won't be able to reverse the change. It seems that governments are playing a very crucial role here, and perhaps the alliance between big businesses and governments. And it seems it's going to take a while for governments to be turned around, led by the protest movement that you talked about at Maules Creek. Governments often change their mind when there's a major crisis, and I'm thinking of the Port Arthur situation and governments. Can you see a major crisis occurring that will force governments to change more quickly?
Yes, there's some discussion of this amongst... In climate circles, and it gets talked about as the Pearl Harbor moment. That's the quintessential crisis that led to a very rapid shift in political support for an idea. And if you had to list what some of them might be, then you might think about a heat wave that was so severe that it turned a major grain exporter into ceasing all exports, or you might think about a superstorm that came on top of sea level rise that was supercharged by ocean warming striking one of the major financial centres giving it severe flooding. If you're paying attention, you realise these things have already happened, both those things I just mentioned. You can think of others too. I mean, a Category 5 hurricane hitting Miami a sustained drought in the US Corn Belt. But again, that happened, worst drought on record, one of the worst droughts on record, just in the last few years. So it's sort of a... it may be that there is one of these events that happens that suddenly crystallises government support, but I don't think you can rely just on that, because there have already been plenty of enough warnings for governments to wake up. So yes, you're right that it is a matter of timing, and every year we wait. The International Energy Agency estimates that the ultimate cost of decarbonising rises by $500 billion US due to us locking in sunk costs into infrastructure largely. and needing to move more quickly. what does it require? It requires multiple things happening simultaneously. It requires an increasing popular resistance. It requires a shifting in the financial assumptions of the stock market so that fossil fuel stocks no longer seen as such profitable investments. And that happens when people fear that governments might actually follow through on their promise to limit temperature rises to 2 degrees. Because if governments were serious about that pledge, then that would mean that we would be leaving most fossil fuels in the ground, and so the value of fossil fuel companies would currently be very significantly overpriced. And these are the conclusions of not sort of radical fringe groups, but of things like the World Bank and HSBC, who have been warning about a carbon bubble. That is, that share prices of fossil fuel companies are likely overestimated at the moment, on the assumption that they will end up burning their entire reserves. But at some point, I do think there will be a bit of a dam burst. It's how do we bring forward the day that happens? And I think we need to be just sort of addressing it at multiple levels simultaneously.
Thank you for a cracker for the talk. I'm just wondering about, particularly theological, it seems to me like I'm an Anglican minister coming from Sydney Evangelicalism, we really have neglected the doctrine of creation, and to the point, you know, I mean, obviously I believe in the priority of the doctrine of redemption,
yep. That
we want to get people to become Christians, but if that's your sole focus, then your view of the world is minimal and you're escaping from it. And I feel there's an inadequate emphasis in our evangelical churches on the whole role of creation doctrine and stewardship. And that's what will drive change from the Christian perspective in the church.
A great comment. And I mean, I do quite a bit of speaking about climate and environmental things. A lot of the time I just focus on that, just talking about theology and give sort of exegesis of scripture along these lines. And for me personally, it was actually a very significant part of my step. The reason that I actually started reading some of the science 6 or 7 years ago was because I'd come to recognise a lacuna in my theology, a missing bit, which was the resurrection. And the more I thought about the resurrection and read about it and reflected on the scriptures, the more I realised that the resurrection isn't just God's tick of approval to what Jesus did or him showing that the cross really worked. The resurrection is the blueprint for the future. It's the blueprint for the future of believers. It's also, according to Romans 8, the blueprint for the future of the world, that the creation itself is awaiting its liberation from bondage to decay and groaning and yearning for that day, just as those who have the Spirit groan and yearn for their liberation, their adoption as children, and just as the Spirit itself also groans, all there in the second half of Romans 8. And so it was increasingly thinking about the implications of resurrection, a full-bodied physical resurrection, the implications of that for a doctrine of creation that led me into wanting to think more about how we treat the world, because I came to realise that it's not just about adding a doctrine of creation to a doctrine of redemption, but that actually we need to broaden and enrich our doctrine of redemption, because when we read the New Testament and discover the richness of a resurrection hope in it, we find that our hope is not for redemption from the world, it's for the redemption of the world. And so, yes, I do agree that this is, I think, an important, one of the important pieces of the puzzle that can help Christians in awakening to one of the ways that I don't think we're doing a good job of loving our neighbour at the moment. Because one of the ways that Christians... I have another section that I didn't include in this presentation, but about some of the maladaptive coping strategies of Christians, the theological coping strategies, some of the moves we make to blunt the impact of this information. And one of them is through a narrow understanding of the gospel that says, well, it's really just about saving souls. rather than seeing God's plans embracing all of his good creation into which he was incarnate and for which he died and towards which he is committed.
Two questions. Sorry. I'll speak up for a moment.
So a few years ago I got on an aeroplane in Sydney and it was 38 degrees. It was 10 degrees warmer in Central Australia. I got off the plane in Toronto and it was minus 33. It was 15 degrees cooler to the north, all of which had human civilization.
Yep.
One would use the term lightning in Canada. But my observation was humans' ability to adapt to quite extreme environments. And I think a lot of the theory going around the adjustments of climate change is adaptation. Now, can't expect another species to have a fairly tough time with it. But for a human's ability to adapt to major differences in environment means that many people, the issue is not a question of whether climate change does or doesn't exist, it's that it does, we will adapt.
Thanks. And that's a point that is often made, and it is a good an important observation that humans are ingenious and adaptable, and that indeed we have adapted to previous climatic changes, albeit of a smaller and slower variety, and albeit with great suffering as a consequence, with some civilizations not making it through previous climatic changes. But as a species, we have continued to survive. So partially my answer is precisely that those changes nonetheless brought great suffering, even if they didn't wipe out humanity, and that's not what we're necessarily talking about here. There's a great deal of harm we can do to our neighbour that falls well short of eliminating Homo sapiens from the planet. But the broader and more important answer is that the numbers we're talking about seem small, 3 degrees, 4 degrees global temperature rise. That's not necessarily uniform in distribution. Some parts see less than that, some parts more. And in general, land sees considerably more than oceans. That is, air over land warms much more than over oceans, because the oceans have a moderating effect. The poles warm much more, particularly the North Pole warms much more than the equator. And so even at a 4 degree rise, you're looking at probably more than double that over some significant parts of the land surface. And you're really looking at very large changes of some of the fundamental conditions of existence, with some parts of the globe moving into new ranges that are not experienced anywhere on the planet currently, and even for places that just shift to, say that Canada shifts to be more like California, all the infrastructure in Canada is currently built for Canadian temperature, not for Californian temperature. So the big heat wave in 2003 in Europe, by Australian standards, only really hit the mid-30s for a while, but the infrastructure there was such that tens of thousands of people died in their homes from overheating. That's part of the answer, and the other part of the answer is you said that we'll adapt, other species might not. One of the theological perspectives that I also try to emphasise is that we are a member of creation, that we are we may have a particular vocation that we're called to, but fundamentally we're a creature before we're anything else, and we belong with the rest of creation. These are our co-worshippers who in Psalm 148, it's like a picture of a great big choir all singing together. And if we're bumping off our co-worshippers, then that's a great dishonouring of the Creator. And more than that, we really rely on many of those other species. Our agricultural systems are built for a world that is adapted to certain conditions. You can't simply transport the corn belt from Iowa to the Northwest Territories of Canada because there's no soil up there. We are already using most of the arable land on the planet. It's not like there's great new resources of it that will open up as it warms. Now, there may be some, a little bit, But overall, our capacity to produce food on our current scale is still quite dependent on the conditions being at least somewhat analogous to what they are now. We may be able to cope with small flow changes. There's much we can do, much good work being done in plant biology, developing more resistant strains, more heat tolerant strains, more drought and salt tolerant strains. But there's a limit to that. And our best experts say that once we move beyond 2 degrees and we get up to 3 or 4 degrees, we're going to pass more of those thresholds beyond which adaptation starts to break down.